Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Okay, that's a good start.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to the producer, Focus. Focus is best known for his work with Dr. Dre and had his hand in half a dozen songs on the legend's long-awaited new album, Compton, a soundtrack by Dr. Dre. But Focus's work can't just be summed up by his contributions to one album, however well-known. He began his career as a rapper under the guidance of none other than Eric B., but he quickly moved into production. Focus made not just hip-hop, but also R&B for artists like Beyoncé, Christina Aguilera, and Jennifer Lopez. He first came to Dre's attention in the early aughts and worked for his Aftermath label for 7 years before taking a brief hiatus. After several years off and some superb solo albums along the way, Focus returned to help make Compton possible. One might say that the producer's job is in his blood. His father and namesake is the late bassist Bernard Edwards, best known for his work with the great dance band Chic. We connected with Focus via Skype from Los Angeles. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you need to check out another great producer who has his own history with Dre, Denon Porter, on episode 119. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, the man who helped J-Lo declare her love for Ben Affleck, Focus. I wanted to take it back to the very beginning. Eric B. was actually responsible for getting your career started, right?
Well, Eric B. was definitely one of the people that helped me get started because when I was working with him, I was actually an artist. So he's one of the people that helped me get out as an artist, yeah.
So you started as a rapper, which might, for people who haven't heard your solo record and know that you can actually rap, that might surprise them.
Yeah, I hope they don't listen to that one.
And tonight's a never ender. Focus in the mix like a blender. Ladies night, look my way, you looking at a winner. Take you to my crib and make your dinner and find something better to get into. Anything.
No?
Yeah, that first record, it definitely was an identity crisis, and at the same time, being part of the red tape of any kind of major label, being signed to Scotty Brothers on Street Life, and they wanted something like something else. So I really wasn't rapping like myself. I was really trying to hone in on what Mace was doing, what Bad Boy was doing, instead of just really doing what I was doing. So that first record that I came out with, I try to bury it under dirt and forget about it.
Yeah, it was it's hard. It's very, very hard to find.
Yes.
Yeah, there's like one, you know, you can find it somewhere. You do have other more recent solo stuff as a rapper, which we'll talk about later. But moving into the production side, you know, by the late 90s, you kind of got your start, but it was with remixes.
Yes.
Candy.
I was curious about that. Like, how did you fall into specifically working on remixes?
I think that at that time it was the easiest work to get. They just wanted different looks on the same song. So it was really easy to get, especially because I was from New York, being in LA, and so many people were doing kind of the same West Coast kind of sound. So I had a hybrid sound. So it was easy to get the remix work. I had a nice handful of remixes that came out. And plus, they didn't have to pay us full budget. So they didn't mind giving us, you know, a couple of $1,000 to do a remix for a record.
When you were doing a remix back then, how much attention, if at all, were you paying to the original track?
I tried to just learn the chord progressions, and then I took it from there. Because once you pay attention to the original track, I don't know about any other producer, but for me, it stifles me. I just need to know what the chord progression is, and then I just roll from there because, you know, you don't want to rub the chords the wrong way. And I know a lot of people that do remixes, they want to showcase themselves instead of making sure that the song just sounds better. So I didn't want to be one of those producers.
Sure. You will have this weird thing in remixes sometimes, especially I think with some hip hop producers, where they'll accidentally reharmonize something, just kind of put a beat over a song where people are singing, and, you know, there'll be some clashes there.
Exactly. And I didn't want to be just, you know, I wanted them to understand that I was a producer, a music producer, not just a hip-hop R&B producer or urban producer that didn't understand melody and harmony and things like that. So I paid attention to that.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the first original stuff you did was with Soleil back in like 99.
Yeah. I never back down. I do what it takes me. Things getting shaky. Can't let it break me. A lot love us, some hate me, some friends snake me. Sometimes the shit just make me want to grab the toast and lose it. It ain't just
There's an interesting bit of trivia around that, which is that you were working on that. Another guy credited on that same batch of like three or four songs is Tricky Stewart, the guy who would go on to do Umbrella and other huge hits with The Dream.
In addition to all of the songs discussed in this conversation, including Rihanna's Umbrella, Christopher Tricky Stewart had a hand in the production of Britney Spears and Madonna's Me Against the Music, Fabulous's Throw It in the Bag, Justin Bieber's Baby, Mariah Carey's Touch My Body, and of course Beyonce's Single Ladies, Put a Ring on It.
Right. When I first moved out to Atlanta, I was partnered up with my boy Jason Weaver. He had a company called Boob Tube, and at the time, I was really hoping that we were going to sign to Tricky because I understood them a lot more than I probably let on because of their deep roots in the R&B. But we signed to Shakespeare, and it was all one house. It was all one compound. It was Shakespeare, Boob Tube, and Red Zone. So that's how I got on the project with Tricky and Red Zone.
And what was he like back then? Do you have any idea that he would kind of turn into the monster that people recognized him being around, like, you know, 07, 08?
I definitely knew that he was a force to be reckoned with. I mean, at the same time, we were all in the same house. You know, Shakespeare had bills. He had no scrubs.
A scrub like you who don't know what a man's about.
So it was a big year for him. Tricky had Case of the X. You know, he broke Soleil, and then he just, you know, from there they just remained consistent because they really understood what to do when it came down to R&B music.
And you have actually a ton of R&B in those early years, particularly stuff with Candy, who you'd obviously go on to see again on reality television.
Right.
Candy here is the singer Candy Burris, who also has been a cast member of Bravo's Real Housewives of Atlanta since season 2. Focus actually makes a brief appearance on the show in episode 10 of season 3.
But your stuff with Candy, you have, you know, some of the tunes you did with her, stuff like Pants on Fire or whatever, has almost like a Timberland style vibe. Was that where you were at the time, or was that what you felt people wanted? What was going on with that era of stuff?
Again, that's what I'm saying. We were signed to Shakespeare. You have a very, very good ear, though. But we were signed to Shakespeare, and Shakespeare had a very rapid delivery when it came down to drum programming.
Mm-hmm.
So if you listen to the songs that he did for The Writings on the Wall with Destiny's Child, and you listen to the songs that he did with TLC and various artists at that time, all I did was make sure that we remain constant, you know, as a sound. And coming out of his production camp, I didn't want to turn around and sound so left that it didn't sound right.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the stuff that we did for Candy, be it, you know, it had nuances of me, but it really was just trying to push the movement and the textures that Shakespeare Productions was for.
Right. And you even got a credit as a sound designer on some of those tunes. What, for the non-musicians among us, what exactly does that mean?
Sound designer?
That's, I saw that you were credited on some of Candy's tunes as sound designer and MIDI and stuff.
Oh, well, hey, that's funny. I think a lot of that stuff just came from, you know, giving drum sounds, even programming a sound to sound a certain way, and then letting somebody else play it. So I really don't know, because that was a long time ago. But those are the only things that I can really attribute it to.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you did a bunch of stuff with Montel Jordan, who I know was co-managing you.
Yeah.
As well, I think, during that period.
Yeah.
This is maybe like early 2000s, right? 2000, somewhere around there?
Late 90s, early 2000, maybe, because I made the transition to Aftermath pretty quick.
Mm, right.
But, yeah, his wife was my manager, and he was my writing partner. So I was signed to their company called The Enterprise.
My question is, with someone like him, who is in his own right a songwriter and a producer, what are you actually doing when you're producing for him? Are you composing? Are you arranging? Are you just like a recording engineer? What do you do in those situations?
In those situations, I was just a music producer. I didn't try to, you know, overstep my boundaries. I didn't try to write his lyrics or even write his melody. My main concern was making sure that I got to showcase him as the main instrument. And a lot of the work that we did was on his fifth album, the Montel 5 album.
It's number 5. 5 albums.
And it didn't even come out nationally, but I had about 5-6 records on there, and he allowed me just to do whatever I wanted to do.
Hey baby, I like it when you're next to me, with that body horizontally, pretty legs comfortable in my bed in your lingerie, with my pillow under your head and her name. I like you cause you trust in me.
And we had a really, really good time making those records, and we had a great time building the chemistry between us. So it was a good time, and it definitely, you would have heard the different sound from Candy to Montel, you know, if you had those albums. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny you talk about the relationship you guys were building, because he name checks you there in one of the songs.
My man Focus blazed the track, and I wrote it, I sang it, I live it, believe that.
Yeah, it really, really was a friendship. It was more of a family atmosphere. We just really made music. It was fun, especially when I kind of hit rock bottom at a point, and they just came in and was like, look, let's just make music. And we did it, and we started, you know, nailing placements. It was really fun. It was a fun time.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the more prominent pop singers you worked with, I wanted to ask you about two of them in particular, which is, you know, Christina Aguilera,
right,
and Jennifer Lopez.
Right.
And for both of them, you did pretty, in some ways, strange songs, right? For Christina, you did this very elaborate skit into a song called Sex for Breakfast.
Right, right, right.
And when the sun rises, there's one thing on my mind. I want sex for breakfast. Stay inside. And even though
that whole album is kind of bizarre in some ways, but, you know, is a very strange song. And with Jennifer Lopez, you did, you know, Dear Ben, which was very much sort of at the center of this whole tabloid romance.
Right.
I love you. You're perfect. A manifestation of my dreams.
What was it like to see your music end up in kind of strange places like that. Were you aware of the vocals when you were working on it at all? Or
no, with Dear Ben, that was a track that Corey Rooney had heard of mine. I don't remember how they got a hold of my music, but I remember being on the phone with him and Jennifer, and Jennifer was talking about how much she loved the record. She loved the fact that it had a hip-hop essence, but it was beautiful to her. So I didn't know what she was going to write to it until I think it was a couple of days before I went in to mix the record. And it was an amazing mixing session because I got to mix with Bruce Sweetin. And he's one of the, you know, legends of mixing engineers. But, you know, I walk in there and I heard the record for the first time with live strings and Jennifer singing, and he told me what the name of the record was, and I was like, oh, got it. And then, you know, she even had a moment on MTV where she talks about the album, and one of the three songs she brought out was mine, and she was just sitting there grooving to it, and I just couldn't believe it. But then, you know, once that romance was over, that song was buried, you know?
Yeah, I can see how she wouldn't want to perform it or talk about it or anything.
Yeah, I don't think you want to talk about that around your new husband or
right,
something like that.
Right,
yeah?
Right. And the Xtina song?
Christina is, she's an amazing, amazing artist. And she heard that track and she loved the track. She loved the honesty of the track. She loved that it was sparse. She loved the chord progression. So when she came up with Sex for Breakfast, it was me and this other writer named Detail. And she was like, you know, I'm married now. I could talk about stuff like this and, you know, and what I do with my husband. So when she started writing that record, that's what it was. It was her step into womanhood, I guess you would say. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's a mother now. She's a wife. And, you know, so she wrote that record. And it was amazing to watch them get down and do it. And like, even the interlude before it, I was in there messing around and I wrote that and she liked it. And she just went in and respit the words that I wrote and the melody.
Touch me here, touch me there, let me give you one and deserve. Ooh, I'm not hungry for food, all I want is you.
I honestly, I'm still honored and privileged to hear that now.
Yeah. And, you know, going from pop superstars to perhaps the pop superstar, you did a song on Beyonce's first solo record.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of different for you in some ways. Very, very minimal tune. You have the backwards sounding.
Yeah, guitar.
Yeah, yeah. I guess backwards guitar on it and the vinyl noise and all that kind of stuff. How much of that was your idea? Like, did she have any input on kind of the atmospherics of that song?
No, that track was all me. That's more my style than people would even want to believe. Like, the vinyl stuff is just the fact that I'm born in the 70s, so I have an affinity for vinyl. So having that sound in my tracks just gives me that analog feel, and it just makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to different sounds and textures and things like that, I'm more experimental because I like getting influenced by various things. Like the guitar was me playing, but then I wanted it to sound different. So I just threw it backwards and it worked. And then I made the drums big because that's where I'm from. Like, as far as New York is concerned, the aggressive drums that I've used my entire career. Like, I try not to have minimal drums. Like, I do the best I can to have just aggressive drums on every track that I do. So when she heard that track, I couldn't believe that, you know, it made the album because I thought it was different for her. But it worked out.
Yeah. And, you know, one other time that you did something with Beyonce was actually the Destiny's Child, the Spread a Little Love on Christmas Day.
Yeah, that's another
Christmas
one.
Song,
yeah.
Which is also another in that vein, a sort of minimal sounding, you know, R&B tune. Did you have any idea at all when you were making it that it would end up as a Christmas song?
Not even a little bit. I just know that because Kim Burse was working with Beyonce, and Kim Burse is a good friend of mine, and she told me Beyonce was working on projects. She told me to give her a CD of music, and I did. And that record came out first, and then she heard the Yes track on there, and that was on the next album. So it was great that they even, you know, believed in me to allow me to have that chance, you know.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned the vinyl noise, and you know, coming from the 70s and things like that, and it makes me think to jump ahead to more recently. On your Analog in a Digital World, the solo instrumental project you did.
Yes, yes.
You have that song, East and West.
Sound without focus is just noise.
Noise, noise.
Right, which has a tribute to the Mardi Gras break.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so how important... as when you were sort of getting your feet wet as a producer, how important was that canon of, you know, frequently sampled records to you? When you were starting out, did you make beats from Mardi Gras and Apache and Substitution and stuff like that?
Of course. I mean, those were your, if you really are a vinyl collector, those were, you know, staples in your collection. So they're go-to beats, they're go-to drums, they're go-to sounds, and it's go-to inspiration. So when it comes down to Mardi Gras, when it comes down to Nautilus. When it comes down to Substitution. When it comes down to Skull Snaps. You know, there's so many records that I can name, but these are, you know, Ashley's Roach Clip. Like, those beats are so staple in hip hop, and it's like those are the ones that you go back to just to find a different way to flip it. Maybe you could do it different than, you know, Molly Mall, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you can start to make your name, and that's all I used to think about in New York. Like, I had all of those drum loops, but I'm like, how am I going to stand out if everybody's using them straight up?
Right.
So, you know, just learning how to splice a snare out of a Substitution to where it was clean. You know, trying to find out how to get just the bongos out of, you know, the bongo rock. You know, things like that. Like, I really, really just became a student of it because of those things.
Yeah. We definitely have had other producers on here talking about, you know, using just skull snaps for hundreds of individual beats.
Here's what episode 117 guest KDAV had to say about the break from It's a New Day by Skull Snaps.
I can literally definitively say I have about 30 beats with Skull Snap drums. At that time, I was just sampling everything with him because it was just like, yo, this was the hottest beat ever. I mean, Steezo used it. And, you know, everybody sampled Steezo's version. Even Primo, you know what I'm saying? For Take It Personal was Steezo.
Man, you have no idea. I think that was one of my favorite loops, and especially because it was my my best friend's favorite loop. So every time he rapped, I had to throw that on.
Amazing. And, you know, you took some of that training into the tribute series or homage series you did a while back.
Yeah.
Where you did, you know, homage songs to a bunch of different producers, Pete Rock.
Yeah.
And, you know, Daz.
It's my tribute to the West. Check. With so much knock in the LBC, it was hard not to claim that DPG. Summertime popped in the LAC with the music, courtesy of DAZ in the soup.
Right.
And Trey.
Yo, everywhere I travel, the Trey haters babble. Them niggas is afraid, they bleed Minute Maid. Producers so comfortable living in the shadow, they sip lemonade, chilling in the shade.
And Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
I be hating sucker MCs and sucker producers. I never tried to make a beat until I heard the Uma. Five mics twice and that wasn't even they best. Midnight Marauder and women with painted breasts.
When we asked Cypher episode 94 guest Von P of Tanya Morgan what it was like to record the homage to Ali Shaheed with Focus, he told us the following. It was a dream to be a part of the homage series. That's all I could say, really. I consider it a check mark on my rap bucket list.
when you are making a beat like that, that's supposed to be like in the style of another producer, but not literally a cover, not literally like a copy of one of their songs.
Right.
What exactly are you copying? Like, what elements of their style are you like thinking about and trying to put together? Like, essentially, what makes, you know, when you were thinking about that, you had to think a lot about what makes a producer's style. Like, what kind of stuff were you discovering?
I think this is probably one of the most brilliant questions I've ever been asked in my life. To be honest with you, when I did the Pay Homage series, and I never even got to finish it because it was about seven more that I wanted to do. But these are people that I've been studying my entire career. So it's everything that makes them who they are. Nuances, familiarities, like anything that makes them who they are. When it comes down to Pete Rock, that long, what is it, Long Red Mountain, a long, whatever it is.
Oh, the mountain tune.
You out there?
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's one of those things that, for me, I just equated to Pete Rock. I do. When it comes down to filtered bass lines, I know that I can do that with Pete Rock and Quest, but there's a way that they EQ it. You know, when it comes down to DJ Premier, he doesn't have to use a straight-up sample. He can use a bit. It's literally a bit, and he builds this entire composition around it. So when you pay attention to detail on each one of them, you can find what it is. Because when I did RZA, I didn't even use my real rig. Like, I dummied down my rig to make it sound like I was sitting in a room with Wu-Tang with a Fostex 4-track and, like, one drum machine and a beat-up mic.
Homage to the RZA.
For someone who's a shouting mic.
My whole thing was capture the era. Mm-hmm. And that was really important to me. And I didn't go back and listen to records of theirs because it was so ingrained. I just went off of what I remembered and what they gave me as a new producer. Like, these are people that I look up to. And so it was just really easy to go in and go, you know, I love Pete Rock for this reason, so let me just do this beat like I would think Pete Rock would do it.
Yeah.
And it worked out. Like, I didn't have a chance to do the other seven, but I got some amazing artists on records that they probably wouldn't even have thought to put together, you know?
Yeah, and the vocalists just sound like they're having so much fun, too. I mean, that must have just been a blast for them to be a part of.
Yeah, it was amazing, and it was a labor of love. There was nobody on there tripping about licensing, nobody tripping about money. It was literally a call, and it was like, guys, I got this project I want to do. Right now it's not funded, you know, because I was really trying to build a buzz and awareness and then try to get, like, maybe a stone's throw or somebody to jump behind the Pay Homage, because I wanted to really, really go at it. Like, I had the Beat Nuts I was going to do. I had so many more people, and I had everybody lined up, but I didn't want to just keep using their talents and not paying them. It was more of a barter system, you know? But it, like, even though seven, like, I'm proud of them. I'm proud of what happened.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of styles of different producers, listening to a bunch of your stuff,
mm-hmm.
I noticed that in a lot of tunes, I would say, you know, more often on your instrumental stuff, but sometimes in the tracks you've done for other people, you use bass in kind of a cool way, in a way that's often melodic and not just supportive.
Right.
You know, you'll have the bass kind of doing a lot of melody type stuff. Where does that come from? I mean, to take the most obvious thing, do you think that comes from your dad?
Of course. Yeah. Anything that has to do with bass comes from my father.
Focus's father, Bernard Edwards Sr., was a bass player, singer, songwriter, and record producer, both as a founding member of the funk disco band Chic and on his own projects. He and guitar legend Nile Rodgers formed Chic with drummer Tony Thompson and singer Norma Jean Wright in 1976. They went on to record an incredible amount of era-defining music, including Dance Dance, Dance, La Freak, and of course, Good Times. He and Nile also produced and recorded the instruments for other artists, including Sister Sledge, Diana Ross, Johnny Mathis, and Debbie Harry. They made tracks that included huge hits like Upside Down, I'm Coming Out, and We Are Family. He also worked with tons of other artists, including Adam Ant, Rod Stewart, Air Supply, and Duran Duran.
I think a lot of that, even now, just listening to a lot of his back catalog, I'm still in wonderment on how he figured out how to make the bass so prevalent and so apparent in a track, but still as an underlying groove and a part of the foundation. I still don't understand what was going through his head, but I do the best I can to interpret what I've learned from him.
One of the things about the songs that he and the group did, both as Chic and that they wrote and produced for other people, is this quality of timelessness.
Yeah.
You know, I've noticed that their songs from the golden era of their career, right around when you were, you know, a young child,
right,
will always, as far as I can tell, be played on, you know, at events and on dance floors and stuff, basically until the end of time.
Right.
Being so closely around that, what did you learn about this balance that they struck between having things that were hits but also had elements of being timeless?
I think what I had the chance to see, especially from behind the scenes, it wasn't like I got to get up and go write a hit. They went up and they wrote honestly from a place that was creative. I think my father and Niall were geniuses. You know, when you listen to the lyrics, they were simple. When you listen to the arrangements of the vocals, they were simple. But I think that when they understood their strong points and their strengths as producers and arrangers, they put the complexities in places where I don't think anybody was understanding or focusing at that time. Nobody was worried about the strings flying around like they were, but it gave them a good feeling. Nobody was understanding the push-pull between Niall and Dad when they would play, you know, rhythmically and just how they complemented each other. But at the same time, it was a tug of war. And it really was just something that was honest. It wasn't something that was premeditated. And I think that translated, and it definitely made their sound a fingerprint, you know?
Mm-hmm. And do you have a favorite song from your dad's catalog?
That's a good one. My favorite ones are off the beaten path. So all of the jazz stuff, like São Paulo, Savoir Faire, Open Up. Like, I really have a long list of them, but it's all the jazz stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting back to your work, a bunch of the stuff that you did starting out, you know, Soleil and even that song you did with Joe, there's a bit of what sounded to me kind of like a classical music influence, either in the way the melodies and parts work together or in the Joe song where you literally use classical guitar.
Right.
What kind of influence did classical music have on the stuff you were doing?
I'm a big fan of violins and classic guitar, even flamenco guitar, but I like textured melody, like textured instruments, things that can put across, I don't know, movement, I guess you would say. So it's not just regular chords, regular, you know, strumming. It's something different, something textured. And I know that I found a lot of that stuff listening to the classical guitars, even Django, listening to Joe Pass, you know, different people that had different styles of playing. It really, really was intriguing. And their chord progressions were amazing. So I think a lot of that was just really me just being a student, but finding the stuff that I liked.
And one other thing about the way you produce that I love is your choices in timbre, right? And sound. Wow. You know, thinking of some of the stuff you did solo, even like that NSYNC song you did, right?
Yeah,
on the hook, you know, this awesome bass sound kind of comes out of nowhere and then drops out.
I can see you with another guy.
How important when making a beat to you is timbre? Like, how is the sound you use, how does that connect to the process of composing?
That's another great question. I think that people are so busy trying to throw all of these sounds through the middle that they're not really understanding that frequencies resonate, and they resonate in a person, you know? So I do the best I can to make everything feel warm and feel inviting. The main instrument in any production should be the artist. So I'm not really trying to be aggressive and throw everything down the middle so that you know who I am. I think that it's very important to pay attention to sound, especially working under the tutelage of Dre. Like, we don't sit down and just make a beat and then throw it out to the wind. We make sure that it's right. Every sound is right and it has its place. I'm a heavy believer in the element of surprise. I don't want you to understand where I'm going to go. Sometimes I try to throw my own self off, you know, so it's really important to give the listener an experience instead of just giving them something to listen to.
And, you know, something that's a bit unusual about your career path is there's a whole sort of swath of songs you did of non-English language rap, right? Including stuff that you won awards for. You won a Latin Grammy for, you know, Mala Rodriguez.
Yes.
When you're working with a vocalist who's not in English,
right,
does that change what you do at all?
No. It's one of the greatest things in the world, because when you get in the room, the only language that you both can speak is music. And that was the easiest thing in the world. When I worked with Salah could speak English, but we did his entire album in his native tongue, and it still translated wonderfully.
De nachtmerrie, jong moslim Marokkaan. Geen school, geen werk, zogenaamd asociaal. Vaste klank bij de sociale dienst. Dezelfde persoon die door Roos wat verdient.
And we got an award for that, wherever that award is. But we got an award for that. Working with La Fouine, we couldn't speak the same language. But we made some music together.
J'aime l'argent sale, démarre le BM. Si le commissaire elle est cassé, alors j'ai du sang sur mes DN, sur mes Air Force 9, anti-juge, anti-cœur, anti-port, les euros sont mes anticorps.
Working with Kamini, we couldn't speak the same language.
Il travaille avec Dr. Dre, quoi. Enfin, mon père, il connaît pas, mais... This man worked with Dr. Dre! You understand?
But we made music together, and it's one of those things that if you like it, thumbs up is universal, you know what I'm saying? So it really wasn't something that we had to have much conversation about. We were in there to make good, honest music, and it happened.
Yeah, and with Salah, just one question. He has a whole song in, I'm guessing it's Dutch, a couple songs where you do the hooks in English.
Yeah.
Does the content of the hooks have anything to do with what he's rapping about?
I guess. from what... there's a few hooks on that album. That was way back in the day when I wrote them. But there's a few hooks on the album that I have my hand in. And I know that one of them, Wifey, is a... And he used the B word. But even that record, I wrote the hook. And I did it for people out in the States. And when nobody was biting, I gave it to him, and he just did it in his native tongue, and it was dope. But I think that a lot of the subject matter, it was way more premeditated before I even came into the picture, because we talked about it, me, Silver Rings, and Salah, that, you know, 50 Cent could talk about his streets, Game could talk about his streets, Dre could talk about his streets, you know, New York could talk about their streets. Why can't Salah talk about his? So for him to do that, all we had to do was just give him the right music and the right platform to speak from.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned Dre there for a second. Obviously, you've had two separate stints with him, you know, from 01 to I think around 08 or so. And then after, you know, a 5-6 year break coming back. So that first stint was taken up, you know, you did a bunch of other songs, but it was largely taken up with stuff intended for Detox. And so I had a couple questions about that.
Sure.
First off, since that record is, you know, by everyone involved announced as, you know, not happening, as DOA, can you describe at all what those songs or those beats sounded like? You know, what kind of style they were, if there were vocalists that you remember who they were? Like, is there anything you can say about that, the stuff you did during that period?
I really, really can tell you that that Detox was a long, long process. Maybe some of the songs that you heard that came out during that time, I can't tell you that they were for Detox, but I know that there were records that we worked on, like The Recipe for Kendrick. I remember hearing that. Also, talking to my diary.
Don't be surprised that I built an enterprise and my house got a view of the city like a high rise. Yeah. I'm just talking to my diary. I'm just talking to my diary. When I open up my book.
So there were records that I remember specifically during the time of Detox, but I can't tell you whether they were for Detox or not. And around that time, we really were just experimenting with a lot of sound. It was a lot of rock. It was a lot of, you know, our older Aftermath sound right around the end of Chronic, the beginning of 2001. So we were just getting more aggressive with it. So it just, you know, it was normal Dre, but I don't think that it was as anthemic, as much of a statement as Compton is. And I think that that's why this record came out and not Detox.
Sure. And what was it like to put in, you know, I guess at that point, 7-8 years of your life into a project, you know, now that you know for sure will not see the light of day?
I think that that's where my eyes were open. And it had nothing to do with Dre or Aftermath. It just, when you do that much work and nothing's coming out, it becomes a frustrating thing. And Dre knows that I'm a very creative and emotional person. And when I do ride with somebody, I'm going to be loyal until the wheels fall off. But the thing is, if we're not putting out music, it becomes frustrating for everybody. I'm sure he was frustrated with me. He wasn't getting what he desired, you know what I'm saying? And I wasn't getting any music out, and it just all became frustrating. So the best thing for me to do was to just show him, like, you know, Dre, I appreciate everything you do. You're my biggest mentor, you know, next to my father. So I just want to show you what I can do. But it was just easier for me to do it outside of Aftermath at that time and to get my life together, get my life in line spiritually, get my life in line with my wife, get my family in order. And it just, it really was one of those things that it was just an eye-opening experience, because nothing was coming out. Like, I didn't have any records coming out, but I was signed to the biggest label in urban music, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned getting your life in line spiritually, and you mentioned, you know, on records that your mom was a Jehovah's Witness. I think you are.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yeah.
So I'm about my business, and no, I ain't going to lie, because I was raised Jehovah's Witness, and no.
How does that affect you in your day-to-day life, being Jehovah's Witness, especially being in, you know, an urban, you know, urban music environment, which, you know, people might not necessarily expect to go well with a, you know, very religious person?
I think that no matter where we are, where we work, there's going to be elements of things that may not be conducive to my way or my lifestyle. But at the end of the day, if I do the best work that I can do, and I do it with a clean conscience, that's all I really can do. And I don't, that's probably a lot of the reason why I don't write melody and lyric, because where their subject matter is and the conversations now, just, it's not even fun anymore. I don't want to hear about it. So whether I was a Jehovah's Witness or not, it's just not where my brain is at. But I can make music all day long. What they write to it, I can't, you know, I don't condone all the time. And not just that, it's not even something that I can control, but I do make music, you know, and it's one of those things that if I can put food on the table with this, then so be it. And until somebody stands up and is like, look, you can't do this anymore. And hopefully that person will be God. But, you know, that's probably when I'll stop, you know.
Yeah. Have you ever explicitly said no to having music of yours used on a record because of the subject matter?
Yes. Yeah. I've had a long ride where I just wasn't willing to work with certain people because of blasphemy. A lot of people, a lot of rappers were getting to the point where they were questioning God, and then they were actually contesting and confronting him in a way that was blasphemous and in their raps. And I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't cohort that. So it was very easy for me to say no. But it does get hard when the finances start to plummet. But it's like, it's one of those things that once you turn around and you have faith and you rely, you know, on God, then you're gonna get through if you're making your stance and you're taking that stance. So we've made it through, you know, and I've been fortunate to have a 25 year career. So obviously things are working out.
Sure. Would you feel comfortable at all naming names of any of the artists that you didn't want to work with?
Oh, definitely not.
Okay. I had to ask. You understand, I'm sure.
It's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good.
So during the time at which you left Aftermath, you did this record Dedicated. I really love it. I think it's a great record. You're rapping on pretty much the whole thing. There are obviously a lot of guests from the, you know, Aftermath family and outside of it. That record, can you talk about where you were mentally when you made it? Because it's, you know, it's a very confident record, but it also is vulnerable in a lot of ways. And it just seems like it's coming from a very interesting place.
Wow. That was definitely before I became a witness, but I was in a very bad place. I was drinking a lot. Niggas know I'm a problem, something hard to deal with. Had the world drinking on Ciroc before Diddy had it pop. It's okay though, my niggas know the real shit. I was very lonely. With all the people around me, I was still very lonely. I lost a lot of fake friends because I'm mad busy. I try to bring them with me, but niggas is mad iffy. I let a lot of hoes trick me. Now I'm so picky. Ain't no woman want to roll with me. Getting pussy because he's... And it was one of those things that you start to really question everything that you're about when you're on high and everybody's around. And then once you start to bottom out and you see the people disappear, the ones that loved you the most. So it was a vulnerable place in that aspect. But then at the same time, a lot of it was just written from all I know. I don't know how to write fictitiously. I don't know how to write about stuff I don't know. I don't write about guns. I don't write about drugs. I don't write about things that I don't do. And everything on that album was who I was. And I think that was a final purging. You know, that was finally getting everything out. That's why it was so many songs. I think it was like 21 songs, 20 songs, something like that. It, you know, I spoke about everything. I spoke about losing my mother. I spoke about, you know, losing my father. I spoke about my kids. But then I spoke about having a good time and drinking. Then I spoke about, you know, having a horrible relationship. Then I spoke about missing that girl. Like, it was everything. And I tried to cover it all because that's who I was. And I think it was just finally just getting it all out, you know, and having the mic to talk to.
Can you see yourself making another solo album where you're primarily rapping?
Well, I did Focal Point 1172. I was born in the city to a music giant, a little too defiant. I traveled west and me and P, we formed a true alliance. I never looked for handouts, I was too self-reliant. I thought the limit... And that was another one, and it wasn't as many songs. It was just more along the lines of me rapping from a place that I know. And talking to the people that want to listen, but I don't have that love. I don't have the love for writing like I used to. Like, I used to write all the time, and now it's just, I'd rather just make music, you know. And the solo projects I'll be doing will be instrumental,
like the analog and a digital world, which is great. The compositions on that are phenomenal.
Thank you.
I don't even hear that as like a beat tape or a sort of quote unquote instrumental hip hop project. The songs seem sort of more intended to stand by themselves rather than as like calling cards for rappers or whatever.
Wow. Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So jumping back to your first stint on Aftermath, during that period, like 01 to 08, you did, you know, stuff for Detox, but there were also other records that came out under the Aftermath umbrella during that period. You know, obviously stuff like the first 50 Cent album, you know, Eminem's Encore and so forth. Were you trying during that period to get stuff on those records as well or not?
Desperately. Desperately. I actually came to Dre and was like, you know, I really would love to work with Eminem. I would love to be on his album. And, you know, at that time, we were so focused on Detox. You know, Dre was like, you know, I don't want you to lose your focus. I need you to really stay the course, man. I need you to stay the course and bring me that record. I need that home run right now. And so I can get, you know, moving on Detox. So it really was one of those things that, you know, as directed, I definitely wanted to stay the course. I definitely don't want to go rogue, you know what I'm saying? But I did have a chance to work with Truth.
Come to have you next to me.
I got a chance to get on Game's album with Where I'm From.
I done seen young Buck scuff Air Force Ones in Cashville, but Compton is where I'm from. Where's just me, my son, and my bitch.
And that almost was one of the first records that you would have heard Dre since Chronic 2001. So, you know, it was one of those things that I wanted to stay the course and make sure that I hit that home run for the coach. But, you know, we ended up where we ended up.
And that Game album is actually celebrating its 10th anniversary right now. I think a lot of people are looking back on it and talking about it right now.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. And then I just heard the new album, and he has a song called Just Another Day where they actually interpolate the Where I'm From track.
Just the other day I seen a glove I had and it reminded me of Easy. Just the other day I had a drink that I did some OG shit with Nate, though. Shout out to the baby.
So that was really cool how that resonated through time.
Mm. And, you know, so with the Compton album, you are had so much to do with it, produced or co-produced half a dozen songs, mixed, I think, 10 of the songs or something like
just
that?
Just seven.
Okay,
yeah.
Mixed seven songs. But this was the first time you were collaborating directly in a room with other producers.
Right.
What was that like?
It was frustrating at first. I've never worked with other people so closely before in so many days at a time. You have to get to learn the people first. And I think that I had to learn, when to go under, when things will go over, meaning, I tried my best to go into a room being humble, but you have to learn how to be even more humble when, situations may go, where you don't expect them to go. And it was just a very humbling experience. And it still is even to this day, because now I'm so used to collaborating, it's hard for me to get back into my groove as a solo producer. So I appreciate this different aspect that Dre has brought into my career, because it definitely broadens your horizons and it broadens your awareness of what's going on out there, because I don't know how to do trap. I don't know how to do a lot of the textures that the kids are listening to now, but I know a lot of producers that do. And if I can give them an element and just be, you know, a part of the song, like now I'm getting it. I understand it's going to give me a little bit more life.
Yeah. And, you know, we actually had talked to Dahi.
He's amazing.
And he does have that element. He uses trap hi-hats on pretty much everything. And so I guess, like, you know, with something like Deep Water, for example, where it was you and him and Dem Joints and someone else.
Cardiac.
All working on that tune.
I just want to make it clear. My influence run deep like the ocean. Don't get it fucked up.
Been away from home.
Can you divvy up for us how that went down? Like what part each of you played in that tune?
Oh, sure. The music, the initial music part of the record was mine. And then Cardiac came in and laid the 808 and all the drums. And we pretty much formatted the song. I did some like the glitching stuff that you hear, all the glitching and stuttering, that's mine. and then we put it all into one session, and then Dahi came in and added his sprinkles, because he has a very amazing way that, like, he uses his voice. Him and Dem Joints pretty much do this as well, using their voices as instruments. So he actually sang in the track and gave me different screams and this and you know, just atmospheric stuff. And then the same thing with Dem Joints. Like, they just came in and really brought the song bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So it, and real talk, like, when it came down to it, once Dre heard it, Dre helped orchestrate it. So it was all five of us that really produced that track.
Wow. And, you know, on Medicine Man, you were brought in, I think, specifically to make Eminem's verse stand out, which is kind of wild. You're like, okay, well, here's the biggest rapper in the world. You're going to make sure people pay attention to him.
In the beginning, a few of the people who had a problem, I was this good scoffed. I just shook off, probably reminded you of the first time you saw Tiger Woods golf. Never thought about how much my race and nationality meant, but based on how I ascended, see how plain it was now, they want me to jet, but no one really gave a fuck about my descent till I took off.
What was that process like?
That's amazing. Dem Joints is probably, you know, one of my favorite producers now, and... You know, I love the record regardless what him and Candace were doing. But when they turned around and they said that they wanted to strip down the second verse because M wanted something different, you know, Dem Joints gave me the opportunity. And I told him, you know, whatever you need from me, I'm here. And he told me what direction he wanted to go. He wanted it more orchestrated. Dre was saying that he wanted it bigger. He wanted it more like, you know, with a lose yourself feeling. So, you know, it was me and Kurt. And Dem Joints and Candace, and we just went in there and I orchestrated the piece, and it was actually longer than that, but I orchestrated the piece, and I just let Dem Joints do his thing, and he let me do my thing. You know, it was really an amazing time. Like, the synergy in that room was ridiculous, and I couldn't believe that you know, when he sent the verse, I couldn't believe it. Like, I wanted to work with M my whole career, and here I am on Compton with his verse, you know?
Yeah. And I read that you said that that Kendrick, who to me is in a lot of ways the star of that album, did most of his stuff in one day. Was that right?
That's what from what I saw, Kendrick did, I think, two songs in one night. But don't quote me, because I didn't stay the whole time that he was there. But I know that he really went in. Mm. And he did, like, I think two of the songs, because I think he's on three, if I'm not mistaken. He did two of the songs, like, in one night.
Wow. You know, as far as the Dr. Dre camp, during your hiatus, you expressed some worry that people wouldn't be able to think of your name and not think of Dre. I think the exact quote is, you know, I will never be able to get people to avoid putting my name and Dre's in the same sentence, and that gets frustrating. And so I know you were feeling that way during the hiatus. What changed to make you kind of want to come back into the fold?
My wife was pregnant. And when you get to the point where you're getting older in the field that you're in, but there are people that still believe in you, you'd be wise to deal with the people that still believe in you instead of trying to beat your head against the door and trying to prove who you are to people that could care less about you. And Dre is one of those people throughout time that has shown me that he thinks I have talent. He believes I have talent. He believes that I'm a good producer. And he always believed in that aspect of my career. And it was just, I don't know, it was a no-brainer. Like, you're the only person that really believes in me and believes that I can make music, then yeah, I'm going to come back over there. And, it, you know, you got to humble yourself. Like, I left because I was frustrated and I'm sorry. You know what I'm saying? And But I know without a shadow of a doubt, I didn't leave kicking up dust. I never would disrespect Dre ever in my life. And I really appreciate him for giving me the opportunity to come back and be a part of Compton.
When you wanted to come back, what was that conversation like?
It was quick. It was one of those things that, you know, my brother Ty was working with Aftermath already. Like, he started... pretty much holding down the A&R spot, but he wasn't the A&R quite yet. But he was playing my music for Dre. So one of those things that if you're going to come back, in any situation, you want to have a peace offering. And thank God my music was a peace offering. You know what I'm saying? Because it just let him know that I was still working and whatever I was doing caught his attention. And that's one of the greatest things, because it made it to where the door was open. If it was closed before, it was open then, you know? So it just really made it to where we could sit down and talk. We had the quickest phone conversation I think we've ever had. He asked me what I wanted to do. I told him I wanted to work, and he was like, when? And I told him I was ready now, and I ended up in L.A. That's how fast it was. And when I came out here and worked, it was an initial 2 weeks, and 2 weeks was go back home, get your family, and come out here, because this is just, we're just getting started. And it was such a blessing, man, because right then and there, I didn't know what I was going to do, especially being in Atlanta. Atlanta's so clicked up, nobody was willing to let me in the click unless I was willing to, you know, start all over again and pay dues again and, you know, and give away 30-40% of my advance and my publishing. And I'm like, it doesn't make sense. Not for all the work that I put in.
Mm.
So, I, you know, it was a great, great opportunity, and I'm glad that we took it.
Yeah. One of the things I heard from Dahi and, you know, other people involved in the project have said, and I wonder if this is any different for you, that no one realized that an album was actually going to happen until, you know, vocals really started. And you're like, okay, well, if Dre is, you know, doing six takes of a song, or if, you know, Kendrick Lamar is coming in to do vocals, I guess this is really happening. Was that when you realized this was real, or was there another point before or after?
It started getting real around that point. I think that we all have our our different views on when it became real for us, but it became real for me when I saw it go live, because I know that anything can change at the tip of a hat.
Wow. So even after the announcement and there was going to be a release date and cover art and stuff, you still, until it was actually up on iTunes, you weren't sure?
It wasn't for me to be sure. It was for me to do my job. But yeah, if I had to be honest about it, yeah. When I saw it go live, I got really excited. Mm-hmm. And I even was in the studio, you know, clapping and screaming, because the thing about it is, when you work as hard as we work on music, the only thing we want to do is to hear everybody say they love it. And even those that hate it, you bought it. So you must have loved something about someone that had something to do with the project. Mm-hmm. And that's all that matters to us. You know what I'm saying? So it was one of those things, just to know that it came out. That was the realest moment for me.
Yeah. One thing you did on that project that you hadn't done much of is mixing. And, you know, I know that that's Dre's favorite part. It's what he lives for. It's, you know, even on albums where he doesn't produce, like Kingdom Come or whatever, he'll still mix, you know, the high profile things. What was it like to be mixing, you know, something for someone who, in addition to being a known producer, is also, you know, an elite mixer, right?
I was scared. I was nervous, but it's one of those things that, for the sake of time, I was not going to tell Dre that I couldn't mix. I mixed records before, you know, I've mixed records for him, but I've never mixed a record with him and for him as an artist. So it's one of those things that I literally, it was so humbling, man. I don't know a better word, but it's like, this is the snatch the stone from the master's hand type situation. And when I did my first mix for him, I played it for him, and I was super confident. And I played it for him, and he listened to it, and he was smiling. He was like, okay, that's a good start. And when he said that, I was like, oh, got it. But there was something that he wanted from the song, and he wasn't getting it. And I appreciate him for teaching me how to get those things out of the music. So it really became a great lesson learned. It became school. And I couldn't wait to get to school every day.
And, you know, I wanted to ask about another sort of Aftermath affiliated artist who you've had, you know, such an amazing creative partnership with. And that's Marsha Ambrosius.
Don Cannon. Big homie Focus. Had to keep bringing good music.
On looking for you, never really the one for my heart. Contemplated compromising, been doing that all my life. Yeah.
What is it about you two that your styles kind of sync up so well?
I think that she's just a genius. I think, honestly, because I can't attribute it to a me and her thing. I think that she's just amazing in what she does, and she's able to adapt in situations that she chooses to adapt to. So when she heard my music and we gelled as friends, it just kind of permeated into everything that we were doing. That Yours Truly record really kind of put the stamp on everything that we were doing from that point forward. And now it's like, it doesn't matter what track I put on, she just interprets my music better than anybody I've ever worked with. And she does it quickly, efficiently, and she cuts herself, and it's not drama, and it's not, you know, unrealistic publishing cuts. It's just music. We're making music, and we do it from a place that's honest, and it's been a pleasure working with her, and hopefully you guys are going to hear some great music in a few months.
Yeah, I mean, that leads into my next question, which is, you know, what's next for you? You know, Compton is out, it's in the world. You know, people know you were intimately involved in it. What's next for you?
Right now, we are just on a surfboard riding this wave until it hits the shore. It's still overwhelming. People still want to talk about it, and I'm glad they do. I wish that the red carpet was rolled out a little bit bigger, better, and longer for Compton. Dre definitely deserved it, but the way that they released the record, it was definitely on a different, it was a different rollout for this project. So right now, we just try to keep everybody excited about the project, and I'm definitely open to work with whoever wants to work. I have my manager Jay Hatch and my management team iStandard. So we're just about to aggressively hit the circuit and see who wants to work, because I like to get in with the artists instead of just sending music, and we're just gonna see what happens, you know.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Focus, for hanging out with us. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you.
The more I really dug into Focus's music as I got ready for this interview, the more I began to look forward to talking to him. The ways he dealt with melody, composition, sounds, and style were varied, unexpected, and always worth listening to. So I was glad to see that he had a lot to say about all of those things as well, in addition to all of the talk about his solo work, his father's legacy, and everything else we discussed. Plus, it was pretty cool to get an inside perspective on the making of Dr. Dre's Compton album. Join us next week when our guest will be Darlene Ortiz, the woman who was by Ice-T's side from debt and broken waterbeds to appearances on Oprah and movie stardom. We talked to her about her new book, Definition of Down, My Life with Ice-T and the Birth of Hip Hop. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter when you're there. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
I don't know how to write about stuff I don't know.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
My wife was pregnant. Nothing was coming out.
Our webmaster is Aaron Young.
He asked me what I wanted to do. I told him I wanted to work, and he was like, when? And I told him I was ready now, and I ended up in LA.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It's really important to give the listener an experience instead of just giving them something to listen to.
Special thanks to our biggest Patreon supporter, Vikram.
Here I am on Compton with his verse, you know?
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I do have it, but I don't know if I can release it. No, I'm not gonna kill it. Why would I do that? No.